Rediscover God's Word, verse by verse, chapter by chapter. This is Real Bible Study with teacher Tom Bradford. Welcome to Torah Class.
If I was to give the middle verses of Zechariah chapter 7 a title, I think I'd call it Caught Red-Handed or Busted. Now, this chapter is so short, so let's reread it to get started. Open your Bibles to Zechariah chapter 7. In the fourth year of King Darius, on the fourth day of the ninth month, Kislev, a message from Adonai came to Zechariah. He sent Sar-Etzer and Regem-Melech with his men to Bethel in order to ask Adonai's favor, as they inquired of the Kohanim, that's the priests, of the house of Adonai Zevaot, and of the prophets. Should we go in to mourning and abstain from pleasure during the fifth month, as we have been doing for all these years? It was then that this message came to me from Adonai Zevaot. Speak to all the people of the land and to the priests, the Kohanim. Tell them, when you fasted and mourned in the fifth and seventh months throughout these 70 years, were you really fasting for me? Was it for me? Rather, when you eat and drink, it's just to please yourselves, isn't it? Isn't this just what Adonai proclaimed through the earlier prophets? When Jerusalem was inhabited and prosperous, as were the cities around her, and the Negev and the Shephelah were inhabited. Then this message came from Adonai, came to Zechariah. In the past, Adonai Zevaot said, administer true justice. Let everyone show mercy and compassion to his brother. Don't oppress widows and orphans and foreigners or poor people. Don't plot evil against each other. But they wouldn't listen. They stubbornly turned their shoulder away and stopped up their ears so they wouldn't have to hear it. Yes, they made their hearts as hard as a diamond so that they wouldn't hear the Torah and the messages that Adonai Zevaot had sent by his spirit through the earlier prophets. This is why great anger came from Adonai Zevaot, and it came about that just as they hadn't listened when he called, so Adonai Zevaot said, I won't listen when they call, but with the power of a whirlwind I will disperse them among all the nations which they have not known. Thus the land was left desolate after them, so that no one came or went. They had turned a pleasant land into a desert. Here's what's happening. The city of Bethel in northern Yehud. Yehud is the name for the Persian province that previously was called Judah. Has sent a delegation of representatives to Jerusalem to get an answer to a pressing issue of major importance to them. And in a nutshell, the issue is that ever since Nebuchadnezzar invaded and conquered Judah and exiled the Judean people to Babylon, those few who were allowed to remain instituted a special day of mourning that they commemorated annually in the fifth month of each Hebrew year. And this mourning involved typical Hebrew mourning traditions, including fasting and communal weeping. Now, clearly the officials of the city of Bethel were aware that God said this punishment of banishment from their homeland would last for 70 years. And by the reckoning of the leaders of Bethel, they thought They were in the 69th year, with the next few months turning the clock to the 70th year. So, should they prepare to stop their mourning in the fifth month each year if their understanding of God's instructions and the timing were correct? Now, although using the vocabulary of the day, these men are said to be bringing this question before God to answer. What this means in practice is that they give their inquiry to the senior priests in Jerusalem, probably even the high priest, since the priests are considered God's servants and thus they have contact with God. Now, the way this contact between God and priests occurred was via use of the Urim and Thummim stones, kept in a special pouch worn by the high priest. And the thing for us to understand is that whatever inquiry was brought to the priest for an answer, it had to be in a form that could simply be answered yes or no, because that's all the Urim and Thummim could provide. Now, the more complex answers to theological problems, more often than not, wound up in the hands of the prophets. The prophets then, hopefully, would get an oracle from God to give to the inquirer, or the prophet may answer according to his own personal knowledge of God's laws and commands. One of the things to notice about Zechariah and the oracles he gets from God, especially when we read words that are Zechariah's versus quotes from God, is that he has a deep knowledge of the Torah. And whether this was typical for prophets in his era, I don't know. The preponderance of biblical scholars think that Zechariah came from a priestly family due to his father's name. Since it is actually the job of priests to know, to teach the Torah to the people, then perhaps due to his father's knowledge, Zechariah knew the Torah quite well. So it seems that God personally intervened. And rather than the priests giving the Bethel delegation the answer to their question, God himself gave it to his prophet Zechariah to give to them. I have no doubt it was an answer they were not prepared to hear. This is what is said in Zechariah 7:5. Speak to all the people of the land and to the Kohanim, to the priests. Tell them, when you fasted and mourned in the fifth and seventh month throughout these 70 years, were you really fasting for me? Was it for me? I'm going to warn you now that much of the remainder of this lesson is going to get rather preachy, not necessarily comfortable, so be forewarned. It is simply the nature of what we're going to study. So allow me to give you an illustration to better understand the biting tone of God's response in verse 5. Men, when you buy your wife that state-of-the-art 85-inch LED 4K TV with bass reverberating soundbar that can shatter windows for her birthday, would you be so foolish as to be shocked when she looks at you through eyes squeezed down to two tiny slits and says, "And you bought this for my benefit? For my birthday? For my pleasure? It was really me you were thinking about?" You get the picture? See, the answer God gives is like this. And it is intended as a reproach and a teaching moment for more people than only the Bethel delegation. It was for all Judeans, lay people and priests, questioning everyone's sincerity and the purpose for their fasting and weeping. God speaks of them doing it not only in the fifth month of the year, but also the seventh. Now, the fifth month, we understand, as when the temple was destroyed by the Babylonians. But what happened on the seventh month that would indicate, or rather instigate, a repetitive time of mourning? Well, the truth is, it isn't 100% certain what the occasion for mourning in the seventh month is. But the high probability is that it refers to the assassination of a fellow named Gedaliah and the massacre of many others. Now, the story of this notorious event is recorded in the book of 2 Kings. But even more detail about it is provided, interestingly, by the prophet Jeremiah. All right, and it's worth knowing. In Jeremiah chapter 41, starting with verse 1, in the seventh month, Ishmael, the son of Netanyahu, the son of Elishama, of royal blood, and one of the chief officials of the king, came with 10 men to Gedaliah in Mizpah. And while eating a meal together there in Mizpah, Ishmael and the 10 men with him rose and attacked Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, and struck him with their swords, and assassinated the man whom the king of Babel had appointed governor of the land. Now Ishmael also murdered all the Judeans who were with Gedaliah at Mizpah, as well as the Kasdim, as the Babylonian soldiers they found there. Well, the next day before his assassination of Gedaliah had become known, 80 men from Shechem, Shiloh, and Shomron came with beards shaved off, clothes torn, and gashes on their bodies, and they had grain offerings and frankincense with them to present to the house of Adonai. Now Ishmael, the son of Netanyahu, went out from Mizpah to meet them, weeping all along the way. And on meeting them, he said to them, "Come to Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam." And once they were inside the city, Ishmael, the son of Netanyahu, and the men with him slaughtered them, threw them into the cistern. However, 10 of them said to Ishmael, "Don't kill us, for we have stores of wheat and barley and olive oil and honey hidden in the field." So he relented. He did not kill them along with their comrades. The cistern in which Ishmael threw the corpses of the men he had murdered with Gedaliah was the one Asa the king had made in fear of Baasha, king of Israel. It was this cistern that Ishmael, the son of Netanyahu, filled with the slaughtered men. Then Ishmael carried off captive the rest of the people of Mizpah, the king's daughters and all the people left in Mizpah, whom Nevar Zadon, the commander of the guard, had committed to the care of Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam. Ishmael, the son of Netanyahu, carried them off captive and left to cross over to the people of Ammon. So, what happened here was that a man named Gedaliah, who was from a prominent Judean family, accepted the role as governor over what remained of the former kingdom of Judah on behalf of Nebuchadnezzar. However, even if Gedaliah and his family saw this as at least a small gesture of goodwill towards the Judeans by giving them one of their own to rule over them, the most zealous of the remaining Judeans saw Gedaliah's acceptance of this offer as aiding and abetting the enemy. So they assassinated him and his family, other Jews that were there with him, and even a number of Babylonian soldiers stationed in Judah. Some Jews in Mizpah, where this atrocity took place, were left alive. But the Judean ringleader of this slaughter took them and fled for the neighboring country of Ammon when it became clear he'd made a huge miscalculation. Now, apparently, the Jews of Bethel and in other places in the former land of Judah decided to remember that terrible day by mourning and fasting annually in the seventh month of the year. Now, what we're hearing and this unexpected response of God to the delegation from Bethel's inquiry is, he is not at all impressed or pleased with these fast days and all this weeping. Interestingly, the most religious Jews, even in modern times, still observe the fast of Gedaliah on the third day of the seventh month of each year. Well, what is the problem in God's eyes with the Jews doing this? It's because this centered on themselves and not on God. What they had been doing was hypocritical and an attempt at self-righteousness. They instituted special holidays, which God had not ordained for them, and they thought them important and obviously their prerogative to establish them. Now, I made light of God's admonition of verse 5 by using the illustration of a man giving his wife a huge TV for her birthday, something which he no doubt wanted only to please himself. I did that because of what I am now compelled to say to you that is anything but lighthearted. To give this some background and weight, here is a most impactful quote to us from Isaiah that pertains exactly to what is going on here in Zechariah, and it ought to open up some serious self-examination and reflection in us all about the things we do that we think are God-pleasing expressions of our personal piousness and righteousness. Hear Isaiah. Isaiah 58, starting at verse 1. Shout out loud, don't hold back. Raise your voice like a shofar, proclaim to my people what rebels they are. To my house of Yaakov, of Jacob, their sins. Oh yes, they seek me day after day, claim to delight in knowing my ways, as if they were an upright nation that had not abandoned the rulings of their God. They ask me for just rulings and claim to take pleasure in closeness to God, asking, why should we fast if you don't see? Why mortify ourselves if you don't notice? Here's my answer. When you fast, you go about doing whatever you like while keeping your laborers hard at work. Your fasts lead to quarreling, fighting, lashing out with violent blows. On a day like today, fasting like yours will not make your voice heard on high. Is this the sort of fast I want? A day when a person mortifies himself? Is the object to hang your head like a reed and spread sackcloth and ashes under yourself? Is this what you call a fast? A day that pleases Yahweh? Here's the sort of fast I want. Releasing those unjustly bound. Untying the thongs of the yoke, letting the oppressed go free, breaking every yoke, sharing your food with the hungry, taking the homeless poor into your house, clothing the naked when you see them, fulfilling your duty to your kinsmen. Then your light will burst forth like the morning. Your new skin will quickly grow over your wound. Your righteousness will precede you, and Yahweh's glory will follow you. Then you will call, and Yahweh will answer. You will cry, and he will say, here I am. Remember those final words of Zechariah 7:4? Were you really fasting for me? Was it for me? See, those words are expressing the same kind of sentiment that God tried to explain to King Saul. about how he views animal sacrifices. The same sacrifices that he ordains in the law of Moses in 1 Samuel 15:22. Shmuel, Samuel said, "Does Adonai take as much pleasure in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying what Adonai says? Surely obeying is better than sacrifice and heeding orders than the fat of rams." Samuel is telling Saul that sacrificing exists mostly because of disobedience. Sacrificing is a most gracious way of God creating a way for us to not get what we rightly deserve. But it costs him a great deal. He requires that innocent creatures that he created and loves must lose their lives as a substitute for our crimes against him. So greatly does he love humans above all other living creatures. God looks first to the condition of our mind and spirit to see what sort of sincerity we harbor towards him. But over and over in the Bible, so many different ways, he tells us that our sincerity and our worship of him can only really be expressed in one way, our obedience. Making up our own religious occasions to worship God or to express some sort of message to him that seems good to us may not necessarily be sinful. On the other hand, if at the same time we just ignore God's appointed times, we disobey his most fundamental laws and commands, and then we see animal sacrifice as a cheap way out of our rebellion, or think that hanging our heads and weeping and fasting because it's an annual day marked on a calendar is going to impress him and convince him of our righteousness before him, well, think again. God already gave Israel a day of mourning and fasting and weeping to atone for their sins and sorrows. Yom Kippur. The more days they fast on an occasion they decided to create doesn't help. It might make them feel better, to feel more righteous. That's all the good it does. So how silly and vain for this delegation to travel from Bethel to Jerusalem to piously ask if it's okay with God if they stop doing something he never told them to do in the first place. Let me make this even more personal and probably more meddling. God has given us his holy days to celebrate. Do we celebrate them the best we can in the challenging circumstances we all live under? Do we do it out of obedience and sincerity? Or is it a day on a calendar? We do it because it's time again. Believers of all ilks, let me take this down one more level. Do you celebrate church-created holy days like Christmas and Easter because they seem good to you? Days that you deem as holy, which seem not only harmless enough, but you actually think expresses a special righteousness. Days that God never instituted or ordained, nor did he give us permission to establish. Do you think you are impressing or even pleasing God when you do them? Or in truth, do you do it mostly because you like it? It gives you a warm, a satisfying feeling. And to put a finer point on it, you do it instead of obediently celebrating the fasts, the feasts, and the Sabbaths that God did ordain. Judaism has invented many days of mourning and remembrances over the centuries, and they have religious services and traditions to commemorate them. Who is this pleasing? God's word says it may not be him. Hebrew roots people. Do you turn around and think it's good to mimic these Jewish but not biblically ordained observances? Or have lengthy and elaborate or expensive services on days God calls out, but on the other hand, he doesn't really ask for what it is you're offering? Then whom are you pleasing? God's word says it may not be him. What matters most to God is our simple obedience. And approaching him and all these things with a contrite heart. He wants us to love our fellow man in practical ways, rather than going all out to do things in an effort to impress him with our righteousness. I have to remind myself about these things all the time. I have to remind myself that even in prayer, God already knows what I'm going to ask before I do. So lofty words and lengthy prayers are for me, are those hearing me, not necessarily for him. God sees me. He knows me far better than I know me. He knows my motives, my priorities, my needs, my secrets, and my faults. He wants my obedience to him, given from my love and allegiance to him, not because it's part of my religion or custom. He wants me to take care of my family, my fellow God followers, and to help people where I can in the ways they need it. He wants me to bless his people Israel, and to stand up for them, and to do it all in the ways he has instructed, not in the ways that I think are better. Now, I'm not saying this to you because this is my opinion. This is what we just read. And I have to tell you, it's pretty convincing to me. These words God speaks to the delegation from Bethel and to us that seem so harsh are not meant to condemn or to beat us down. They are meant to correct and to teach, as a loving father does. So let's not be stubborn or prideful, but rather let's be open to his admonition and his instruction, even when it stings a little, or maybe a lot. Now, verse 6 completes the thought begun in verse 5, as it speaks of eating and drinking. Now, these two terms used together are a common expression that simply refers to a full meal. So, essentially, this idea of fasting for the sake of self-righteousness can even be extended to feasting for the sake of self-righteousness. Therefore, beyond eating only what God considers food, or beyond obeying God's appointed times of fasting, how much food or how little food is a matter of indifference to Yahweh. It has no bearing on one's righteousness to him, but if one attempts to frame it as a show of righteousness, then it brings God's ire. Verse 7 says, isn't this just what Yahweh proclaimed through the earlier prophets when Jerusalem was inhabited and prosperous, as were the cities around her, and the Negev and the Shephelah were inhabited? Now, the earlier prophets mean the prophets that spoke and wrote prior to the exile to Babylon. And what they proclaimed was that Judah was on the wrong track. And without immediate and clear reform, disaster at the hand of God was coming. The question asked here is, of course, rhetorical. That is, the expected response is, yes, it is. We are in a section of Zechariah in which symbolism takes a bit of a break in favor of examining what Judah was told by God through his prophets in the past, but how the Judeans responded, essentially, or generally ignoring the warnings. What the result was, being conquered and exiled, and what the future is going to look like. Now, in the past, pre-exile, Jerusalem was thriving, as well as were the associated fortified cities and villages around her. The Negev, that's the southern desert region of Judah, and the Shephelah, the coastal plain, were also well populated and prosperous. Now, although the hill country is not mentioned, the idea is that all of Judah was blessed and doing well. So verses 8 and 9 continue with, "Then this message from Yehovah came to Zechariah. In the past, Yehovah Zevaot said, administer true justice. Let everyone show mercy and compassion to his brother." So, this is not Zechariah's words or conclusions. These are God's words. Now, what follows are four fundamental precepts upon which all Judeans are to operate in their daily lives, but obviously have not, or there would be no reason to warn. Now, I want to highlight something that it's been a while since I've spoken about, but probably bears repeating. Just as these four fundamental precepts are given, that does not mean all others of God's laws, commands, and precepts have been abolished in favor of only those four. I doubt most anyone would think otherwise. And yet, when we arrive in the New Testament and we have an interested follower of Yeshua ask him about some fundamental precepts, Constantinian Christianity takes an entirely different tact. In Matthew 22, starting in verse 23, "When the crowds heard how he taught, they were astounded. But when the Parashim, the Pharisees, learned that he had silenced the Sadducees, that's the Sadducees, they got together. And one of them, who was a Torah expert, asked a Shelah to trap him, a question. And a rabbi, which of the mitzvot, which of the commandments in the Torah is the most important? And he told him, you are to love Adonai your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. This is the greatest, the most important mitzvah. And the second is similar to it. You are to love your neighbor as yourself. All of the Torah and the prophets are dependent on these two mitzvot, these two commandments. Now the church says that at this moment, Jesus abolished the law of Moses, and he replaced it with the law of love. That is, when asked what are the greatest and most foundational commandments, Christ answered with love God, love your fellow man, and then followed that by saying the Torah and the prophets were based upon those two underlying principles. Saying the Torah and the prophets was an expression, meaning the entire Old Testament. Now, frankly, common sense and a plain reading of what is said utterly refutes the new notion invented by the church to reduce all of God's commands to a single new one called love. Here's a way to mentally picture it. Think of God's commands to love him with all our mind, soul, and strength, and to love our fellow man as ourselves as the two pillars upon which the Ten Commandments are built. The Ten Commandments tell us what loving God looks like, what loving our fellow man looks like. Otherwise, we would be left to decide individually what loving God and loving our fellow man amounts to. And effectively, this is precisely what the church has been preaching for centuries and saying we may now do. We may decide for ourselves. Now, the law of Moses then rests atop the Ten Commandments. In the same way, the American civil law system rests upon the Constitution. Each of the roughly 600 laws of Moses provide a more nuanced and detailed case example of one or another of each of the Ten Commandments to see how the foundational pillars are to be carried out in real life. Where they're emphasizing four fundamental precepts of behavior in Zechariah chapter 7, or the two foundational principles of obedience to God in Matthew 22, that hardly replaces all other precepts, principles, laws, and commands. Now, Judah, in the former Israel, had essentially done what the Constantinian Church has done. It went on its own way. It pushed aside God's commands in favor of their own precepts, then claimed that this is what God wants and it pleases him, despite him saying no to such a thing and calling it rebellion, and eventually exacting a huge punishment upon his people for such a blasphemy. Here in Zechariah 7, God is reminding them of just how they got here from there, and what a terrible price even partial restoration from their exile has cost them. So let those with ears hear. Now, with all that in mind, what does God mean by administer true justice? Why not just administer justice? True justice is referring to God's system of justice. Just as in ancient times, every society in the world today has decided for itself what justice amounts to and how they wish to administer it. We look on in horror to some of the harsh justice systems in the Middle East, for instance, as hands are cut off for stealing something trifling, or people are beheaded for disobeying some nuance of Islamic law, such as a woman not properly wearing a headscarf. We see some societies that find no fault in pedophilia, others that treat the matter with the death sentence. Who's right? We tend to always think, however, our society decides, that's the correct way. But to God, there's only one way. One true justice system. That's his. Any deviation from that no longer adjudicates true justice. But where do we find his system? Well, there's only one place. The law of Moses. So Judah had been adjudicating justice under their own system, not God's. And he is telling them to return to the true one. Certainly, they retained elements of God's system, but modified other parts to their liking, and of course, rationalized, well, God would be approving. Now, fellow believers, I can say with 100% confidence that when our Messiah does return and set up his Father's kingdom on earth, ruling from his throne in Jerusalem, the Torah-based justice system will be returned in full. A Torah-based justice system that should be operating in full today, but it is not. And we see living proof what kind of injustice and chaos and wickedness this has led to. And after telling Judah to administer true justice, return the law of Moses, the second of the four precepts is spoken. Everyone should show mercy and compassion to his brother. Now the Hebrew is chesed and rahamim, And this is just a kind of a very common biblical word pairing. And while both of these words have a range of meanings, mercy and compassion captures the essence of it. And of course, this is referring to human behavior. We should note, however, the addition of to whom mercy and compassion is to be shown. To your brother. Now, the Hebrew word is ach, and it too has a range of meanings. It can mean a sibling. It can mean a close friend. It can mean a fellow Israelite. However, from the context, this is not referring to people outside of the Hebrew community. This does not mean that Judeans are not to show mercy and compassion to Gentiles. But that's not what this particular verse is aimed at. It is like for us today, as followers of Yeshua. On earth, our first obligation to folks is to folks to whom we are to show mercy and compassion is our family. After that, our fellow followers of Yeshua. Then after that, come all other humans. Now, the one caveat I might add to that is a subcategory, that is Israel. We are certainly to put Israel ahead of the all other humans category, although it takes much wisdom to know exactly how to carry that out in the proper spirit. True justice and showing mercy and compassion are organically linked, not separate issues. And yet, as demonstrated by many biblical examples, administering true justice must be first before showing mercy and compassion. It's when we get that order backwards that we wind up with justice systems that deviate greatly from God's, such as in the USA, where in most states, out of mercy and compassion, the death penalty for murderers has been abolished. What has been the result? Even more murder and violence. And just as we must refer to the law of Moses to even know what true justice is in God's eyes, we must do the same to know what true mercy and compassion are in God's eyes. For instance, in the name of mercy and compassion, we now have a few Western societies that offer assisted euthanasia to anyone who wants to end their life, no matter the reason. That in no way reflects God's definition of mercy and compassion. Well, verse 10 adds two more precepts now to the two already given. Zechariah 7:10, don't oppress widows, orphans, foreigners, or poor people. Don't plot evil against each other. Not the best translation. Here's a more literal one. Get this out of the RSV. Do not oppress the widow, the fatherless, the sojourner, or the poor, and let none of you devise evil against his brother in your heart. Most translations leave out the word brother. Many also leave out in your heart. And just as in verse 9, this is mostly aimed at what you do not do to your brother, your ach. And while we could extend this beyond its intent, which more or less is referring to your fellow Judean, we should not do so except as a model for how to treat all people. Here, this concerns itself with how one Jew is to treat another Jew. By adding back in your heart, meaning in your mind, the idea is that all evil begins as a thought. So don't even let the thought of evil get a foothold. And this is a foundational precept. Now, as for the first half of this verse, this is regarding the socially disadvantaged and most vulnerable among the Judeans. Now, typically, this is not about doing something violent against them, but rather has to do with economics, cheating them, using the court system against them unjustly, withholding wages, not paying them a fair wage. But the law of Moses also creates a kind of welfare system for this group by allowing them to glean fields, by borrowing money at no interest, and by being paid at the end of every day without fail so that they can buy food for them or their families. Thus, this connects us right back to true justice. And no doubt this had not been happening. Also notice that here the word sojourner or foreigner is included. That is, this does extend beyond how one Judean treats another Judean. If a Gentile is living among the Judeans and is a widow, fatherless, or poor, they too are not to be subjected to oppression. Now, verses 11 and 12, for me, are as impactful as was verses 5, 6, and 7. Zechariah 7, 11, and 12 says this, but they wouldn't listen. They stubbornly turned their shoulder away and stopped up their ears so that they wouldn't have to hear it. Yes, they made their hearts as hard as a diamond so that they wouldn't hear the Torah and the messages that Yahweh Zevaot had sent by his spirit through the earlier prophets. This is why great anger came from Yahweh Zevaot. But they wouldn't listen. The Hebrew word translated here as listen is kashab, and it means, it carries a stronger meaning than the word listen does in modern English. It more means to heed, to pay attention to. Listen is a very passive term in English, while heed or pay attention is more urgent, involves the element of taking what you're being told seriously. What wouldn't they hear? Verse 12 says, they wouldn't pay attention to the Torah and to the messages of the prophets. What did this result in? God's great anger against them. The underlying concepts in this choice of words are covenant and revelation. The Torah lays out a covenant that all who hope to establish a relationship with Yahweh must buy into. This covenant is the mandatory basis for the relationship, or none can exist. Prophetic revelation is a second means of God conveying his instructions to his people. Both must be heeded. This is why I have long highlighted that the problem with the Constantinian church is that it is founded on the principle that both the Torah and the prophets are not for believers in Yeshua. By doing this, people are led astray. And I fear many are living in a false sense of eternal security as a result. Now, I'm going to pause here for today. But before I do, I'm going to appeal to you all one more time. When an institution and its beliefs are built upon principles that are not the truth, then it cannot be reformed. I have received literally hundreds of letters and emails from people that have belonged to various denominations for decades, and they now realize they've been taught wrong doctrine. So many of these folks, though, naively believe that they are going to stay where they are and reform that church. I've never received a follow-up email or letter from anyone claiming more success than perhaps the pastor has agreed to allow the teaching of the Old Testament. Or perhaps they will attempt to do a Passover Seder of sorts. That's about it. The vast majority of the time, these same people end up disappointed or trying not to be bitter because they are having no luck at all in reforming their pastor or church. It's a hard, hard thing to eventually come to the realization that there is no other route than that of the pilgrims who came to the American shores early in the 1600s. They left the church entirely. They realized after years of their like-minded friends and family members being jailed and worse for even trying to reform their church, that they can't perform religious alchemy. You can no more reform the underlying principles of an existing denomination than you can make gold from lead, because both are fundamental elements that are unique. The pilgrims did not leave Yeshua. They went somewhere where they could obey him without fear of reprisal. If God has spoken to you, and now you can see the tragic error of Constantinian Christianity that prides itself on being disobedient to God's laws and commands, then get out. Get out. No matter what it may cost you in the way of friends and sometimes even family, your relationship with God trumps all these concerns.
For more teachings of real Bible study and to rediscover God's Word with Tom Bradford, visit Torah Class today on the web, streaming TV, or download the Torah Class mobile app.